he talked this morning about Peter, made the comment that we were going to talk about two individuals who made mistakes and some bad choices in their life. We talked about Peter this morning and how that he had denied the Lord three times, and yet the Lord prayed that he, when he would come back, when he would return, that he would strengthen the brethren. And we see that that's what he did. He came back, he preached the first gospel sermon to the Jews, preached the first gospel sermon to the Gentiles. He wrote two epistles reminding the individuals that he wrote to of what they had already been obedient to, but reminding them of that so that they would be strengthened, they'd be encouraged, and they'd be able to continue faithful. Exactly what Jesus prayed would happen. And so, though he fell, and though he fell from the Lord and made a terrible mistake, he returned and did what was right. Unfortunately, this evening, we look at another man that made a mistake, but never recovered from his mistake. Now, he didn't have a bad life. His life was fine. He acquired many goods, and for all account and purposes, it would look like the life of Esau would have been as successful as the life of Jacob was. And yet, it wasn't. In doing the chronological reading that I've been following, read through this account again of Esau and Jacob, Esau selling his birthright to Jacob, Jacob outmaneuvering, by the help of his mother, outmaneuvering Esau to get the blessing, pretended like he was Esau, got his father's blessing. And so he truly, as Esau said, he is named correctly. He is Jacob, meaning one who supplants. And he was a supplanter, and Esau says, he has supplanted me these two times. He has gotten the better of me. The first example that we want to look at, the first mistake that Esau made was the bargain that he made with his brother Jacob. And we want to look at why that was a bad bargain, why that was a bad mistake on Esau's part, and then hopefully find a lesson or two to be found in the mistakes that Esau made. It's interesting that all throughout Scripture, when Esau is brought up, he is brought up as a man who did not appreciate spiritual things. He did not appreciate the value of that which was spiritual. And so we're going to see that Esau, in this case, this is the first time, the first example of him doing that. Let's think a little bit about Esau's birthright. What was it that Esau gave up? The privileges of a birthright can be found in a couple of passages of Scripture. A birthright simply was that right of being the firstborn, that right that one received as a virtue of being the firstborn. You then were the leader of the family. You then were responsible. This is very important because, remember, we're talking about a time during the patriarchal age in which God spoke to the patriarch, to the leaders of the family. And so if you were the patriarch of the family, which Esau was in line to be, then God spoke through you. You led your family. You led your family by the leadings of God, by the revelation of God. God told you what needed to be done, and you then enacted that. What a wonderful benefit. What a privilege that Esau had. But that meant nothing to Esau, that birthright that he had. In Deuteronomy chapter 21, we are told if a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons. If the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then it shall be in the day he wills what he has to his sons. He cannot make the son of the loved the firstborn before the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. We learn kind of in an indirect way what was the benefit of being the firstborn. The law that Moses is talking about here is a man has two wives, and one he loves more than the other, but the one that is unloved or not loved as much, she's the one that has the firstborn child. She's the one that has his first son. And while it's not the son of the one that he loves, he can't say, well, I'm going to make the son of the one I love to be my firstborn. Obviously, it doesn't work that way. The son of the unloved is truly your firstborn, the first one of your strength, and gets the blessing of the firstborn, which, according to Deuteronomy, was a double portion of the inheritance. The family rule was given him. In Genesis chapter 27 and verse 29. May people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you. The blessing that Isaac gave to Jacob, the blessing of the firstborn. The advantage, the rule was given to the firstborn. But there were spiritual advantages too. They were the patriarch. They were the priest of the family. They were the go-between of their family with God. Notice in Genesis chapter 28 and verse 4, being the firstborn, the blessing of Abraham continued through you. The blessing that God gave to Abraham, the promises that he made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. You'll remember that when Isaac became of age and when Abraham, his father, had died, that God repeated those promises to Isaac. When Isaac died and Jacob became and had the right to the firstborn, then those promises were repeated to Jacob. The promises that had been made to Abraham. Look in Genesis chapter 28 and verse 4. May he also give you the blessing of Abraham, to you and to your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham. Verse 13. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord. This is the dream that Jacob has. I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Jacob, even though he's yet to even be married, he's escaping for his life, getting away from his brother Esau, because this is right after he has taken that blessing from Esau. And so he's escaping and he stops and he sleeps. And when he takes that rest there, he has a dream and God appears to him and gives him this information. Tells him that you're going to continue that promise that I made to Abraham. It will be through you that this will be fulfilled. So the question then is, well, why was this a bad bargain? The Bible tells us that one of the things that Esau did is he chose the sensual over the spiritual. In Hebrews chapter 12, and verse 16, verse 15 says, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. That there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. If you go back and you read through the life of Esau, I've been doing that this past week, you'll learn that Esau was just not a very godly man. You'll remember, or you may remember, that he took two wives of the women of the Canaanites that lived around him. And then you remember that when he saw that it displeased his parents, and that they were concerned about Jacob doing the same thing. And so as he heard that they were sending Jacob off to go find a wife from close relatives, that Esau thought that he would ingratiate himself to his parents. And you remember that he married a wife from the descendants of Ishmael. Even when he tried to do what's right, he only half did it. Only got halfway there. He made a lot of mistakes. And he became an example of a man that was just totally bereft of understanding spiritual values. He chose what he wanted. He chose what appealed to his senses. He chose what seemed right to him. He let his desires, his lust, he let these senses dictate the decision of the moment. And so we're not surprised then that when he comes in and he is starved, the only thing he can think about is his senses are screaming to eat. His desire is to eat. He could care less about the birthright. And in fact, he is a little melodramatic and he says, "What good is my birthright if I'm dead? Because I'm about to starve to death." And of course, he wasn't that bad. But when one's senses is governing one's actions, then that becomes so powerful and so strong, it is as if I don't get fulfillment, I'm going to die. And so that was what it was in the mind of Esau. This thing that Esau did is that he chose the present over the future. There was no thought at all for the choices that he made in the present, what that would do for him in the future. He thought nothing about future consequences. He wanted it. He needed it. He was going to die if he didn't get it. And so he did whatever he had to do to get what he needed. And Jacob was there to make sure that he got what he wanted and to take advantage of Esau. Esau only thought for the moment. He did not think for the future. He did not think the impact of selling his birthright for a pot of stew. We look at that and we think, how could someone's value system be that skewed? We've already seen what the birthright did. You became the priest and the patriarch of the family. You were the go-between, the mediator between your family and God. What an honor to have God speak to you on behalf of your family, and you speak to God on behalf of your family. What an honor. A double portion of all that your father had. And yet all that Esau could think about was right in the moment. That's as far as his thought processes went. And all the things that we've looked at, he didn't even consider. I want to ask you a question, and that is, are we making the same kind of bargain sometimes in the choices that we make? Think about our birthright. Think about what we have at our disposal. The Bible tells us that we have. And it's interesting the parallels that we have with Esau in that what is available to us, what we have, what we can have. Look at these things rather quickly. Galatians chapter 3 and verse 29. It's interesting that in reference to the promise of Abraham, we stand in the exact position as did Esau, that we are heirs according to the promise. Esau could have been an heir of that promise that had been made to Abraham. Isaac was. Jacob, Esau's brother, was. The 12 sons of Jacob were. And all those that were members of the 12 tribes of Israel were heirs of the promise of Abraham. When they inherited that land, that was what belonged to them. That was given to them. That was a part of the promise of Abraham. When they became a great nation in the land of Egypt, they became a great nation because of the promise made to Abraham. They were heirs of that promise. Esau and his people and his descendants had no part to play in that whatsoever. He lost out on that. You know what? We stand in a similar position, the Bible tells us. We too are heirs, can be, according to the promise made to Abraham. We can receive that benefit too. The benefit that we receive from the promise of Abraham is that spiritual aspect of it. No, we're not going to become a great nation. No, we're not going to inherit the land of Canaan. But we are going to get that third aspect of it, and that is we're going to be blessed by having salvation granted unto us, afforded to us by faith in our Lord. We have that same blessing. That's part of the promise made to Abraham. In you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Galatians 3:29. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants and heirs according to the promise. Joint heirs with Christ. Romans chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. The Spirit Himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, heirs also. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with Him, so that we may also be glorified with Him. Notice that we are heirs of eternal life. In Titus chapter 3 and verse 7. So that being justified by His grace, we would be made heirs according to the hope of eternal life. We're heirs of the kingdom. The kingdom belongs to us. We are members of the kingdom. In James chapter 2 and verse 5. Listen, my beloved brethren, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which He promised to those who love Him? Peter tells us that our inheritance, that of which we are heirs, is in heaven. To obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. I read an article this past week of a woman who a few years back died in a hospital. She was about 104 years old. Nothing really peculiar about that, except that she was worth $300 million. She had been the daughter of a man who had made it rich in copper mines out west. And she had spent the last 20 years of her life in a hospital. She was well enough to leave, but she was a little bit of a recluse and probably had a mental issue or two. And though she was well enough to leave, she didn't want to leave. Well, needless to say, that money became a squabble for the distant relatives that she had, which all were basically step relatives from her father or mother's side, I believe it was. And then the two wills that she had. She had two wills. She had one will that had written out all of the step relatives and had instead a new will that had given money to the nurse that took care of her, to the doctors that took care of her, to the hospital that had been so good to her. And needless to say, when you have money and people think that they have an inheritance and that they are heirs of that, it got nasty. And they're still yet squabbling over who gets the money. We may have thought about, boy, wouldn't that be nice to have a rich uncle die and leave me $300 million? Oh, I don't be greedy. $1 million would be fine. I can handle it with $1 million. You know, I don't want to be covetous. And so we think, well, wouldn't that be great? We hear about all these people, or we hear individuals sometimes have these long-lost uncles and then even realize that they had a relative and they leave them a good sum of money. No, don't settle for that. You see, if you settle for that, you're just pulling an Esau. That's what Esau pulled. Esau got what he could get now without thinking about what he had. What he had at his disposal was far more valuable than that which he got. Sometimes we make a bad bargain and we make decisions and we make choices and we sell that out. We sell that out for what? Something that's going to be burnt up one day when the world is destroyed? That's not as important as the here and now. We make the same mistake that Esau did. Well, quickly, what I want to do is I want to show some areas where I think we might be doing that. Are we making a bad bargain when it comes to giving in to sin? Because when we give in to sin, what we're saying is, whatever that sin is, whatever that particular choice that I've made or that particular temptation, I'm saying that's more important to me than my spiritual birthright that I have, than my inheritance that I'm waiting for. in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 24 through 26, this was exactly the choice that Moses made. He chose for the future. He was so different from Esau. Can you imagine, had Esau been in the shoes of Moses, what Esau would have done? Well, we don't have to imagine. We know exactly what Esau would have done. He was a man that didn't think about spiritual things. He would have looked at his situation where he was at in Pharaoh's household, a prince of Pharaoh, the privileges and the benefits of having that, a cush life, an easy life, money more than he could ever spend, maybe even the possibility of one day ruling if his other brother didn't rule, one day ruling Egypt. The possibilities were endless. Where do you think Esau would have been? Well, he'd still been in Egypt, waiting on the money, waiting on the opportunity to rule. Moses saw things a little bit differently. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. You know what that decision got Moses? It got him 40 years, first of all, in the wilderness herding sheep. I don't think that was a promotion coming from Pharaoh's household. And then it got him another 40 years of leading a bunch of stiff-necked and uncircumcised, ungrateful, griping, complaining all the time group of individuals. But Moses looked at the choice and he said, you know what? I'll endure the ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Sometimes when we make choices in reference to what is more important and we choose that which is spiritual, we choose to keep our inheritance, we choose to keep heaven, it may make our life a little more difficult. The man or the woman who comes to the Lord and realizes he's in his third marriage and he doesn't have a right to have that woman, it's made life more difficult for him because he realizes, I can't be in this relationship and keep my inheritance. And so I'm going to have to make a choice of the spiritual over the sensual. And so I don't lose my inheritance, I'm going to make that choice. And I'm choosing a way that's going to be difficult. I'm choosing a way that's going to be hard. I'm choosing that which others will be able to enjoy, but I won't be able to enjoy that. I won't be able to have that kind of companionship. I won't be able to have those kind of intimate relationships. I won't be able to have that, but I will have heaven. And so he makes that choice. He chooses the spiritual over the physical. There's any number of times that I think individuals find themselves looking at a choice. And what we have to ask ourselves is this worth giving up my inheritance? You have an inheritance. An inheritance more valuable than if you had the whole world. Is this choice that I'm about to make, this decision that I'm about to go with, is it worth giving up my inheritance, giving up that which is eternal? If I give in to sin, and I've just pulled an Esau. I've done exactly what he did. Am I making a bad bargain when I lust for the things of the world? It is difficult to live in America and not struggle with materialism, because you get it from commercials, you get it from people at work, you get it from your neighbors, you get it at school. The pressure to conform and to succeed, the pressure to look the part, the pressure to wear the right things, to drive the right automobile, to live in the right place, to have the right job, to choose the right friends, all the things. It's difficult to live in America because we are bombarded with materialism. On the same scale, the benefits and the blessings that we have because we're so materially blessed also can become a curse really quick to us, in that we struggle to maintain what is important, the spiritual over the sensual. And to remember, as the unjust steward remembered, these things that I've been given are just a stewardship that I have, and I should use them in a way to make friends with the mammon of unrighteousness, as he said, so that I'll have eternal dwellings, eternal habitations. But it's hard. We read this verse this morning, James chapter 4, you adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. The lifestyle that we choose to have, the debt that we choose to get into, the just day-to-day choices, maybe just from the standard of living that I have, often reflect the fact that I'm lusting for the things of the world, not being satisfied with just what I need, and then waiting for my inheritance to come. I pulled an Esau when I do that. There's a third way that we can do that, and that is when we just choose to walk like everybody else. We just walk after the flesh. You know, you're either going to live according to your desires and your senses, or you're going to control those. For Esau, he couldn't control his desire. His desire was to eat, and so all else was succumbed to that desire to eat. And that one choice, maybe he was a generous man. Maybe he was an individual that was a caring man. But in that one particular incident, that one particular circumstance, he chose that which was the flesh. The Apostle Paul talks about the fact that, boy, we live in a world and in a body that is the constant struggle. Am I going to listen to the lust of the flesh, the desires of this body that I live within, or am I going to think about listening to the Spirit of God? And Paul talks about this struggle. And you look in Galatians chapter 5, in verse 16, I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh. For the flesh sets its desire against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. For those are in opposition, or these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things which you please. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. And then he gives us a list. List of the flesh, 19 through 21. The fruit of the Spirit, 22 and 23. If I'm not sure of how I'm living, the choice that I'm about to make, the circumstance that I'm in, and the decision that I'm about to render, I should go over here and say, okay, does this look like it fits into the works of the flesh, or does it look more like it's going to be a fruit of the Spirit? It's a proof of me walking by the Spirit. I need to figure that out. Or else I may find myself making a bad bargain. Fourthly, I would suggest to you we need to learn how to hold on to our birthright. We need to protect it at all cost. We need to recognize the value of that and recognize there is not one single solitary thing the devil, this earth, can give in exchange for that. Isn't that the point that Jesus made when he asked, what can you give in exchange for your soul? Even if you were to gain the whole world and lose your soul, you've made a bad bargain. You've changed that which was temporal for that which was eternal. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14. I think I should have said that the other way around. That which was eternal for that which was temporal. Yeah, that works better. Hebrews 12, verse 14. Pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. The one thing that I need to be concerned about, brethren, is to live a holy and sanctified life. Now, sometimes that's going to make some difficult choices on me. And the difficulty won't just be at the choice. The difficulty may be living that choice. If I'm trying to live a sanctified life, back to the illustration that we gave, and here's someone who's in their third marriage and they recognize they can't be in that marriage, but to live a sanctified life, they've got to get out of that marriage, and that's a decision that's going to be hard at that moment, but it's also going to be a decision that's going to be hard for them the rest of their life so long as they live, as they attempt to live a sanctified life and live the consequences of that decision. But I've got to believe that when they make it to heaven, that life that they lived, that choice that they made, I don't think they're going to regret that. I don't think they'll look back and think, I don't think I made such a smart move on that one. I don't think anybody will. So we need to make sure that we hold on to our birthright by living sanctified lives. We need to make sure that we hold on to our birthright by overcoming bitterness. This is all in the context of this reference to Esau. All of this leading up to Esau. All of these are the things that needed to be done, and yet that Esau failed to see the importance thereof. Overcoming bitterness. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 15. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. You see how that works against what we just read in verse 14? If I'm trying to live a sanctified life, then I'm staying away from anything that defiles that life, right? Now, we might think, well, that would be immorality. Well, that'd be part of it, certainly. Living a sanctified life is that. But also, it's my attitude toward others. It's my attitude toward brethren. That's why he says, be at peace with all men, because that is a way that I can live a sanctified life. And by doing that and making sure that I'm trying to live at peace, in order to do that, I can't be walking around with bitterness all of the time and be aggravated and put out with brethren. I can't do that. If I do that, I'm letting that moment, that situation, dictate my life. And I'm becoming like Esau. I'm thinking for the moment. I've got to figure out how to get past bitterness. Someone makes me angry. Someone says something I don't appreciate. Well, talk to them about that. Don't let that swell up. Don't let that stay there. Talk with them. Now, you know what? It takes a lot more courage to go and confront that than it does to hold on to it and stay bitter about it. That's a coward's way of doing it. Anybody can do that. Anybody can sit in their living room and fuss and fume and be aggravated, but it takes courage to say, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to live a sanctified life. I'm not going to live like Esau would have lived and hold a grudge as he did against Jacob and say, when dad dies, I'm killing him. And that's why Jacob left. Instead, I need to learn to get out over that, get past that, or else I'm going to find myself making the same mistakes that Esau did. The last thing I want to suggest to you is that we live a life that is disciplined and godly. 1 Timothy chapter 4. 1 Timothy 4, 7 and 8. But have nothing to do with worldly fables fit only for old women. On the other hand, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. For bodily discipline is only of little profit, but godliness is profitable for all things, since it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. Discipline the body. You think about athletes, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and you tell me the professional athlete that does not discipline his body. When we were watching, Luke and I was watching a lot of the U.S. Open tennis this past month. And every once in a while, they talk about a certain player, and they talk about the work ethic of that player. And that's all they did. They trained for 4 hours. They went to the weight room or went to the massage therapist or went to the trainers for 2 hours, and they were back training again, working out on the court again for another 4 hours. Why did they do that? So that when they got to, and you could tell them talking about this, you'd watch some of these matches, and when they'd get to a five-set match, they'd then talk about the training of the athletes and who was better trained, who had been more disciplined in his regimen of being in shape, who had done the work in the gym, who had done the work on the court, so that if they ever got themselves to a five-set, four-and-a-half-hour marathon match, they could come out victorious. And that was a lot of work in the gym. That was a lot of sweat. That was a lot of pain. That was a lot of discipline. Sometimes I'm not sure that we, and I'm speaking to myself, use the same discipline. in reference to the heavenly things that we have afforded us. By discipline and godliness, we can hold on to our birthright. I don't ever know of a single athlete that ever completed a five-set, five-hour marathon that said, after he won the crown or the tournament, they ever say, you know, I think next week I'm not going to work so hard on my training because I don't really see that benefiting me much. I've never known it. But they thank their trainers. They thank the individuals that saw the need to it for them to be that trained, disciplined. Football players who lose weight in the offseason and come back quicker, faster, stronger. And they talk about they're ready to play. Why? Because in that 3, 4, 6 month period in which they were off, they took their discipline seriously. And because they did that in the off season, they were ready when things mattered. If you're here this evening and your life is not what it needs to be, let me suggest to you that there is nothing in this earth worth jeopardizing our inheritance over. Not a thing that we see. Nothing. We get excited about a lot of things that are going to remain earthbound. We get bent out of shape and upset. What we need to do is to come back and say, well, now, wait a minute. Is this, in the greater scheme of things, does this really have an impact on my inheritance and what I'm an heir of? And if it doesn't, then that'll bring you back to reality and to the fact that, you know, I'm getting excited about a lot of things I really don't need to get that excited about because they really aren't that important. I need to quit acting like they are important and remember what really is important. If you're here and your life is not what it needs to be, don't be an Esau.